Hi, this is Mike Delp with the Relax Back UK show on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. On the Relax Back UK show, we explore all kinds of health topics, so keep listening and enjoy the ride.
Hi, and thank you for joining me, Mike Dilt, with the Relax Back UK show. This week, the show is made possible by the kind sponsorship of AlgaCells. AlgaCells uses the body's own stem cells' ability to regenerate tissue to treat joint and spine injuries and pain. Check out their website, algacells.com. Now, have you ever wondered what work a cancer researcher actually does? Well, you're not alone if you have. I was lucky enough to talk to scientists from a couple of different labs at UCL in London and find out what they're researching, how they do it, and how that fits into the ultimate goal of finding out more about the way cancer works and to derive potential treatments.
Yeah, my lab was working on what is called cell signaling. So if a cell, a normal cell or a cancer cell, receives information from the outside world, you know, what does it do with it? And we're sort of trying to understand what's happening inside.
Bart van Hazenbroek's lab looks at how cells communicate, and Chris Tate's lab looks at the environment tumours are in.
So what my lab's really interested in is understanding how cancer cells talk to and communicate with the environment that they're living in, because we know it can affect therapy responses, we know it can affect clinical progression, and we think it's an opportunity for novel therapeutic treatments, you know, rather than targeting just the cancer cells themselves, maybe think about the environment that they're in, if they're supported by it or even hindered by it in some cases.
I ask how the researchers think, how they come up with their lines of research, and also, importantly, there are patients as well who ask their questions and give their point of view. This really is a fascinating group of people to talk with, so please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at AlgaCells know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. AlgaCells, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. AlgaCells, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
There were six people in the chat, two lab heads, two PhD students, and two patients. So to start off with, I just got them to introduce themselves.
So I'm going to go round in order that people are on my Zoom screen, so in no particular order. So first of all, top left of my screen, we've got Dave.
Hi. I'm Dave Tutor, esophageal cancer patient, survivor, working very hard in getting the voice of the patient in research as best I can.
And fantastic. Thank you. Right, let's move on. Jackie is next.
Yes, it is. My name's Jackie, as you can see, and I was a cancer patient, breast cancer patient in 2003 and aimed to join the PPI movement and change the world.
Okay. Next up, Sarah.
I am Sarah. I am a PhD student at Bart's lab, currently doing my second year of PhD.
Okay, then we've got Chris.
Hi, I'm Chris Tape. I lead the Cell Communication Lab at UCL Cancer Institute, mainly funded by Cancer Research UK, and we're looking at how different cell types interact in cancer.
Fantastic. Next up, Bart.
Hi, I'm Bart van Hazenbroek. I'm a professor at the Cancer Institute, same place as Chris.
I'm a scientist interested in fundamental principles of biology and looking to apply that to cancer research and treatment.
Fantastic. The last thing is Callum.
Hi, so my name's Callum. I've taken some time out of training to be an NHS doctor to do a PhD in Chris's lab.
Good. Right. Well, look, thank you very much to you all for taking some time out of your busy day to chat. I think seeing as we've got sort of two labs here that are, I would imagine, trying to answer some big questions, I want to start by bringing in the lab heads and seeing if they can just sort of summarize the big questions that they're trying to answer, and then just put a little bit of meat on that as to, you know, why that's a useful thing to try and do. So let's start with Chris. Can I pick on you, please?
Of course. Okay, big questions. Okay, so I mean, I suppose we can start with some big numbers. So, you know, the human body on average contains about 50 to 100 trillion cells. So it's an incredibly complicated system. Just, you know, we take it for granted, we walk around every day, this incredibly incredible complexity with us. You know, if Brian Cox is standing on a mountain somewhere looking up at the galaxies, you know, he said there's about 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. So there's about 25 to 50 times more cells in your own body than there are in all the galaxies of the universe. You know, this is the kind of complexity that we're dealing with just as a basic, healthy organism. And of course, cancer, you know, which is what we're here to talk about today, happens in the context of that complexity. So every single tumor that forms, whether it be in the blood or, you know, in a solid tissue organ somewhere, has to form in the context of all this complexity that's happening around it. So what my lab's really interested in is understanding how cancer cells talk to and communicate with the environment that they're living in, because we know it can affect therapy responses, we know it can affect clinical progression, and we think it's an opportunity for novel therapeutic treatments, you know, rather than targeting just the cancer cells themselves, maybe think about the environment that they're in, if they're supported by it or even hindered by it in some cases. So my lab develops new technologies to try and understand these problems.
All right, I'm sure there's an awful lot there that we can pick your brains about a little bit later. So next up, Bart, you have another lab working on another big question. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, my lab is working on what is called cell signaling. So if a cell, a normal cell or a cancer cell, receives information from the outside world, you know, what does it do with it? And we're sort of trying to understand what's happening inside. It's a bit of a network. You can compare it to a railway network or a metro network. And we were discussing yesterday, and I also tested this on my wife, to explain this to a non-scientist. You know, if you think about London and Edinburgh, you know, I'm sort of looking at London as a cancer cell. I'm trying to understand the railways in there, how it all connects with each other. And, you know, Edinburgh has a similar type of simpler network. And so we try to understand that and understand really which stations are the most important ones, which ones we can stop from working. And maybe then the cancer cell is actually not working anymore either. I think what Chris is like looking to do, if you compare London and Edinburgh, suppose London moves into Edinburgh place, that's horrible. You know, that's not happening. So, you know, I think this signaling can actually make things move, make cells move around, respond to their environment, and do, you know, move from one place to another. And we're also interested in that. So my work and that of Chris is actually very integrated. It's not separated.
Okay. All right. So let me ask a question, but based on what Chris said, how many cells? 25 trillion cells in our body.
Yeah, 50 to 100. I mean, it's hard to count, yeah?
It's amazing that anything works at all. I mean, you know, we're so complicated.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's kind of surprising that so many of us are so healthy. But we within those trillions of cells, it's hard to imagine any sort of communication at all making sense. So do our cells really communicate? Do they really talk to each other, and kind of how and why is that important?
Sure. So I mean, I think like to sort of, you know, to break it into a metaphor, I suppose, it's very similar to what economists talk about in terms of the way societies are organized in terms of exchange and specialization. So we can say, okay, we've got these trillions and trillions of cells, mind-boggling numbers, but they're not all the same. You know, so in our body, we all have the same, you know, pretty much the same genome in every single cell in our body. But they, what happens during development, you know, as the body, you know, as it grows, you know, in utero, and then, you know, as you go through development as a human, you get specialization of different cell types. So you might have a single genome, but then you'll, you know, the cells that are in your eye, for example, that can detect light, are very different to the cells that are in your big toe that, you know, you feel when you stub your toe. But they've got the same genome in them, but what they've done is they've changed and differentiated. So in the same way in a society, you know, you've got people who've got different jobs, you know.
I'm just going to hold you up. When you say they've got the, sorry, I'm interrupting. When you say they've got the same genome, you mean they've got the same set of instructions to make me? Or to make
exactly
anyone.
Yeah, all the pretty much all the DNA at a sort of fundamental level is the same in every cell in your body, especially when you're younger. I mean, it might diverge a bit as you get older, but generally speaking, it's a stable system. So what happens is the genes that get expressed and turned on and used in each cell type is different, and what that creates is specialization of different cells. So every cell in your body, you know, has slightly different roles. So you have immune cells that might, you know, look for infections, or you might have epithelial cells in your gut or in your lungs that can transfer things from the outside into the inside when you take up food. Obviously, nerve cells transmit signals. They all got the same DNA in those cells, but they've differentiated. So in order for all that to work, you need to exchange information between the different cell types, because, you know, we're not just a blob of the same cells, mm-hmm. kind of just doing the same thing over and over again. So that can work over multiple different ways. Cells can touch each other, and that can cause signals to transmit between. In the same way, you know, you might be able to sort of poke someone to get their attention. Cells can kind of do an equivalent of that in a very specific way. They can also send out signals. So they create proteins, which can then, they're signaling proteins, which can then transfer between cells and tell one cell type to do something that the other cell wants it to do. And of course, there are things like hormones, which, you know, you'd be familiar with. They might come from, you know, the pituitary gland, you know, above half of your body that could do something in the bottom half of your body, can go right through the blood. So there's lots of...
Why is this important in cancer? The talking.
Exactly, yeah. So that, we've been talking, yeah, about sort of healthy biology. And in cancer, what happens is a lot of the mutations that then come along, which change the genome of the cells that then cause cancer, they often change the communication profiles as well. So, for example, my lab works on the gut. We work on colorectal cancer, bowel cancer, and it, mutations that happen inside those early cancer cells, they start changing the way the environment, the cells, the healthy cells that are around the cancer start to behave. And that can then cause the cancer cells to grow even faster, because they can sort of co-opt and bully their environment and sort of get them to play along with the okay. journey of the cancer, even though that they're otherwise very healthy and well-behaved.
All right. Now, I'm just going to stop you there. So essentially, you're saying if some of the signaling doesn't quite work, something can potentially go wrong. Right. Shortly, I'm going to get the next lab head to kind of add what he's doing. But one of our patients on board, Dave, was just saying he wants to add something to that.
Yeah, it's with so many cells in the body. And is it just a tiny little mutation in a cell that causes a cancer, which then affects all the other cells around it? Or is it a group of cells which just stop working properly?
Yeah, I mean, I think as with everything in science, it's always a bit more complicated, but because we actually find that there are mutations that around the body that don't cause cancer. And this is kind of quite an active area of research as well at the moment. But what we do know is when you get combinations of the same mutations, often in the same cell type, in a way that it's been able to survive, it will then grow and then coerce the environment. And also one thing we haven't talked about is the immune system. You know, these cells that get these mutations have to somehow avoid the immune system. If they're being naughty and growing and, you know, and doing something that maybe isn't helpful for the body, often the immune system was the first thing to step in and say, no, we don't want that. So they have to hide from the immune system essentially as well. So there's lots of things that have to go right. You know, you think about all these in order for a cancer to form, there's so many cells in the body. In theory, we'd be riddled with cancer all the time, but we're not. Yeah. Actually, it's a very rare process, cancer. But it's just happening on the background of so many possible opportunities because there's so many cells.
Yeah, Chris, I think we will come on to the immune system a bit later, because you've got a student with you who kind of specializes in that, I think. Now, next, can we please get on to the next lab head, Bart? And if you could explain the sort of bigger part of the or the big question, the part of the jigsaw that your lab is working on?
Yeah, so Chris was quite eloquently explaining that, you know, you have all sorts of mutations and you create a kind of a network. So the key is really to find out what are the critical nodes. You know, what is really important there? Because we can't interfere with everything. So what my lab has been doing over the last, 20 years, is trying to identify some of these critical nodes and then try to make drugs that block these critical nodes. So to just interfere with this complex network in what we think is a smart way. And, you know, I have had the pleasure to discover something that we have taken from a gene to the research, drug development, and is now an approved drug. So some of our science has translated to clinic. And, you know, we're trying to identify more. So, you know, we sort of, and I try to, you know, train people like Sarah to help me to identify these critical nodes in this network further.
Okay.
And so they are signaling nodes. So, you know, I focus really specifically on signaling. There are different layers, but signaling is our expertise.
So signaling is a type of communication.
Yes.
And
yes.
You look to disrupt that signaling when it's sort of not good to have.
Yes, correct.
Okay, right. Now, because there's six of us, I'm going to bring in a couple more people. You guys are both lab heads, so you're doing all this work, but you're not doing this work on your own. You've got a bunch of people helping you. And in fact, we've got a couple of PhD students with us now. So maybe I could please ask the PhD students to explain their projects that they're doing within both labs. So maybe I can start with Sarah, please.
Yes, Mike. So as Bart just mentioned, Bart's lab focuses more on the signaling and what goes wrong with this signaling for this cell to go bad and turn into a cancer cell. So for instance, my project specifically focuses on, it has like two parts. So one part is understanding the normal biology or normal signaling and how under normal circumstances the cell should be working, because that's one thing. So you need, in order to know what's going wrong and how to stop it from going wrong, is understanding the normal way of working first, no? So that's one part of my project, understanding the normal biology. And the second part is I'm trying to make a model in order to test the drugs that we have, that we're working on currently, and know how this drug is working, if it's working, how to refine and understand if it's actually affecting the points that we expect that it's affecting in the system or in the pathway of the signaling or not.
Okay, so is the idea to test if a drug is working, but you can know immediately, you don't have to wait until the tumor starts to get smaller or goes, which could take a few weeks. You know, we could take this new drug and then you can tell, bingo, it's working.
No, that's really tricky. That would have been that would be amazing and in an ideal world. What we do usually in the lab is testing in vitro, which means I'm testing it on living cells or on cells that are outside an organism, right? So cells, naturally, we try to imitate as much as possible the normal tumor environment so basically we have a mini model where we can test the drugs on. We can't go directly to a human being for obvious reasons. So we go usually from cells and then to animals, and then we go move forward to clinical trials, which is on humans. So when you test drugs on cells, you can, no matter how intricate you are with trying to imitating a tumor, you can never imitate the complexity of a full organism. Okay. So naturally,
I think your boss wants to add something, Sarah.
I think, you know, just to explain this or to summarize all this, you know, Sarah is designing a test to see whether our drugs act on the cell and does what it blocks, what it should be blocking. Whether it works in the patient, that's maybe, you know, that's another matter. But it's actually quite important to know that what you think you're doing with your drugs is actually happening. So we need a readout. We need a test. People do clinical tests all the time. You know, if you take something for your cholesterol, well, you're going to have a blood test and then you're going to check whether your cholesterol is down. So it's something similar in a way, you know, to a readout.
And I suppose the other big question is, if you've developed a drug which stop some communication, which might be make the tumor cells grow or whatever. Perhaps you're stopping some other communication, which you might kind of need.
Exactly. That's part of why we tested first. The thing is, it's hard to translate what we see in cells and expect this to be exactly how it's working in a human being. So that is where the tricky part goes. So yes, even if there are plenty of drugs that do work on cells, but then in a full complex environment, they don't, because as you said, they can interfere with other signaling. We don't know how much they interact with the rest of the environment. So that's part of the research.
Sure. No, very, very important. Okay, we're going to hear shortly from the next PhD student, but I can see that both the patients we have are keen to chip in. So, Jackie, you were waving your hand a moment ago. So please do Sarah, add something.
Thank you, Sarah. It sounded almost as though you were explaining the concept behind the development of Herceptin, where the signaling occurs not only in the breast but also in the heart. And this is why it damages the heart. Would that be correct? Almost.
Yeah. I mean, put in a very simple, I was trying
start
to
off by telling us what Herceptin is then, Sarah, in your answer.
Okay. I don't know how to explain it in a very simple words. I think Colm would be better at this since he has more of a clinical background than me. I'm going to leave it to him to simplify
that's fine.
It.
No worries.
All right. So this is the other PhD student we haven't heard from yet. And you're going to explain your project. But first of all, you're just going
to start with Herceptin. No worries. So basically, I mean, as everyone's spoken about so far, our cells need to communicate with each other. And often cells can express different protein markers on their surface. And that's how they can receive or send signals, basically. And what Herceptin is, it's called an antibody. You may have heard about antibodies in the context of COVID and vaccinations, but it's not just in immunity. You can actually use an antibody to block and grab onto proteins in the body. So what Herceptin was made for was to be an antibody that binds to a protein on certain cancer cells. And the classic example here was breast cancer. So it binds to this protein on breast cancer cells, and it's thought that that antibody binding helps to block some of these signaling processes. But as Jackie also mentioned, the problem is that that all of us face is that often these proteins are expressed all across the body. So actually Herceptin sometimes, in some of the patients that it's treated with, can bind to cells on the heart. So sometimes you have to be very careful monitoring these patients that although you're treating their cancer, you're also not actually hurting their heart. So it's a balance between treating the cancer, treating the healthy cells, and not obviously causing the patient more harm.
Okay. Does that go some way towards answering your question, Jackie, do you think?
Certainly does. And I was very aware of, and it's a good explanation for patients. Thank you.
Good. All right. Now.
Can I go ahead,
Dave? Next patient.
Yep, but you mentioned whether or not it works in a patient is another matter. Why is that?
Well, you know, we start with simple models in the lab, cells that we have taken from a cancer patient and grow them. But, you know, as Chris explained, these cancer cells are not living on their own. Yep. So we need to look at the whole organism. And, you know, my lab uses animals, mice, to understand that to move from a cell to a mouse, to an organism. And what we have actually done, rather than sort of making medicines to start with, we have sort of been tinkering with these genes.
Yep.
First, before making a drug, we try to inactivate the gene in the same way that the drug would do. And then we look in a mouse that doesn't have the cancer, what's happening? And, you know, one of the mice we actually made developed colitis, so inflammation of the guts. Then it turned out 10 years later, if you use this drug in patients, the key side effect was not only on the was colon inflammation. So we tried to go from cells to organisms, mice in our case, to the patient. And, you know, our work has actually been quite successful in predicting some what they call on-target side effects. So basically something that really hits the target that you're interested in, But what are the side effects? So studying that in an organism that does not have cancer is one way of trying to find out what the vulnerabilities, side effects would be.
A
patient would be very well prepared, much better prepared for treatment if they can, if you can provide them with an anticipation of possible side effects.
Yes, and you know, I would like to express in a way a frustration here that some of this science that we published in top journals, when it then goes into development, that the pharma industry has not paid sufficiently attention to this, and some things have gone wrong. And I knew as a scientist that this was going to happen, but I'm a basic scientist, I'm not a doctor, so my voice is not necessarily heard. Mm-hmm. And you know, the side effect of this drug is, you know, diarrhea, you know, and very serious. So this can be overcome. So if you know in advance, why not? So I think this integration of basic science, drug development, clinical work, patients, you know, I think this is so important. And today we have an example of this.
So is that sounds like something that you think that's kind of lacking a little bit?
I think it is. It is. And so what is happening now that, you know, people like Chris or myself, you know, your reputation grows a little bit. And then slowly but surely, you know, you sort of become like into this clinical world as a non-medic in this, you know, commercial world of drug development. And, you know, your voice starts to be heard more. But it takes a while.
Sure. Okay. Well, maybe we need some plenty of people that are studying medicine and also doing a PhD. That's a crafty way of me pulling in Callum.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Callum. Give us an outline of your PhD.
Sure. So as Chris mentioned earlier, he mentioned the concept of the immune system in cancer. So as many people may not actually be aware we always know that the immune system is involved in fighting bacteria and viruses. And we've heard a lot about vaccinations of the COVID-19 pandemic. But actually, one of the major roles of your immune system is actually fighting cancer. So a big part of my PhD is trying to sort of exploit certain types of the immune system and make them better at fighting cancer. And I do this via sort of genetically modifying them to help them do that process in the context of colorectal cancer. But simultaneously, I'm also trying to understand how the immune system talks to the cancer cell, because that's a big part of how the immune system can kill cancer cells. So that fits in with Chris's lab and the technology that they're trying to develop there.
Okay, beautifully put. So effectively, are you trying to supercharge? Actually, sometimes these sort of phrases upset me because we've heard lots of odd phrases, certainly during COVID. Yeah. So let's not use supercharge. What should we use? Just make the immune system a bit more active when it sees cancer cells.
Yeah, because the thing is what you can do with the immune system. So, I mean, there are hundreds of different types of cells that make up that immune system, but some of them are built to fight cancer. Like that's their actual job in your body. So you can either try and make them better at doing that job where they may be failing in a cancer patient, or what you can do is you can take another type of the immune cell, which isn't really designed to fight cancer, but you can try and make them also fight cancer. You're sort of making different soldiers for that sort of fight, if that makes sense. But mainly what I'm doing is taking a T cell, it's called a gamma delta T cell, which normally can kill cancer on their own, but I'm just trying to make them a lot better at doing that. So you could say supercharged if you want to. That's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Can you describe in a way that I might understand how you're changing those T cells? What are you actually doing to them?
Yeah, so basically one of the ways that your immune system talks to each other and helps develop is they release lots of different signaling proteins like we've spoken about. And some of those are called cytokines or interleukins. They've got different names. And basically what I'm doing is I use special types of viruses. I make different viruses that can basically genetically modify these T cells. And I can tell the T cells to make more of these proteins. So I use one called IL-15. And that basically tells this T cell to be very sort of happy and proliferative, and it helps it fight the cancer better. Because one of the big problems we have is that you in your tumor in the body, you've got loads and loads of immune cells in there that want to fight the cancer. But basically your tumor is telling them and communicating with them saying, no, we don't want you anywhere near us. And you can tell them to go away, and you can actually make your own immune system work against you. So hopefully this engineering strategy that I'm doing, so changing the T cells, can help overcome some of that problem.
Fantastic. So could that potentially lead to a vaccine against this sort of cancer?
Potentially.
Or,
so,
or I mean, a type of treatment?
So in my area, it's not sort of vaccine-based, but I mean, vaccine-based treatments for cancer have been tested and have been developed for quite a few decades now. There's so many different strategies for overcoming the immune system, just because it's such a complicated system. But mine is specifically about trying to change certain anti-cancer T cells to help fight a patient's cancer.
Goodness. All right. Now, let's, if I may, let's bring back in the lab heads, Bart and Chris, and talk about some of the time scales of this. Now, Bart, you've been running a lab for, you know, many years. Chris, possibly slightly fewer years. You look a bit younger. I don't know how old you are, Chris. But just mention some of the time scales we're looking at here. Because, you know, the research that Sarah and Callum are doing, it doesn't mean there's going to be a drug next week at all, does it? Just give us an idea of kind of the enormity and the time, the length involved, and also what the process is.
Sure, I mean,
Chris, go ahead.
Bart, I think you're probably better qualified to sort of talk about the full process, but I can say just briefly, you know, just all of these, every single failed drug, and there are a lot of failed drugs, was once a good idea at some point. It was somebody thought, okay, this could work. And so we're kind of in the lab trying these ideas and seeing what works. And these are sort of lower systems, but then it has to go through this process of, you know, going to an animal model, going into, you know, non-human primates, for example, phase one clinical trials, phase two. Most drugs fail. There's an enormous pile of drugs that were once a good idea that now don't work. So it's an incredibly long and expensive process, actually. It's incredibly expensive to get a drug to clinic. And Bart would know more about this than me, but it's not like we can just come up with an idea and then a year later we're testing it in patients. There's an enormous journey that costs a lot, you know, a lot of time, money and people to get it there, which is frustrating, but it has to be there for safety reasons as well. We can't just throw, you know, you can't just go down the pub and have an idea with your friend and then start putting it in a human next week. You know, there has to be a lot of checks and balances there, but I'm sure Bart can speak to the process in more detail.
Yes, you know, and I think that I would like to answer in two ways. First, how in this process of an approved drug, how it has worked so far, and how I would like to change it. So the first thing, you know, I arrived in this country 29 years ago, and I discovered something that I thought was interesting, one of these critical notes. I thought, you know, I'm going to follow this. So that's 29 years. It took 25 years until this became an approved drug. And so what it is, you have a gene, you do basic research in cells, then we made a mouse with this gene inactivated. We publish some really good papers. You know, that's the equivalent of an Olympic gold medal. You publish in Nature, Science, you know, it's sort of, we got onto BBC websites, you know, it gets promoted. Pharma, biotech starts to be interested. Small molecule drugs are starting to be made. We work with those people. I was involved in a spin-out company myself. That was then, you know, goes from small company to a big company. And, you know, this ended up in companies like Gilead, Genentech, Roche, the big pharma, who have taken it through the clinic and it became an approved drug. So it's 25 years. It's too long. Mm-hmm. But, you know, science has also evolved over time. So now we can do things quicker. If I may, Mike, what we're doing
please do
now. So rather than doing all this sort of genetic tricks to start with, you know, I have been working with pharma to try to make drugs straight away to test my ideas, rather than doing all this complicated intermediate step. And so what's happening now that we have something interesting, we think, and, you know, again, we try to publish a good paper. So hopefully it will work. And, you know, you get a lot of attention. We then already have this starting molecules to make a drug. So we save 10 years of time. You know, so, I'm a bit older I don't have 25 years anymore to do it.
How are you saving the time? Is this through different techniques in the laboratory?
Yes, and by making drugs straight away to test my ideas. You can do that now.
Okay.
Rather than doing all the genetic tricks. But okay. It's a risk. But so, it's a time-saving exercise.
Okay. Can you outline some of the techniques that, because I, you know,
yes,
show public,
yes.
That's me. We've heard a lot. Ooh. They're using AI. They're using artificial intelligence.
I know.
To come up with new drugs and ideas. Is that part of the process?
It is. It's part of it. But, you know, in this case, I had an idea. And I approached one of the UK pharma and they have what they call an open innovation project. They work with academics. And no, they have a library of 2 million plus drug-like compounds. And I say, look, I would like to test your compounds on my molecule. I have an idea. Can we put the two together? And, you know, through a miracle almost, you know, I found really a needle in the haystack that worked on my thing. And now immediately we have this protein that I want to target, the drug target, and I have the drug. But it's, you know, it's going to be quicker. And, you know, what happened is that they said, Bart, this is not going to work. So, in fact, I worked with them in the past and they said, you know, we used to work with you, you know, quite well and so on. And we enjoyed working with you. We're going to work with you to prove you wrong. I said, well, that's a good deal. So, and that's how academics work with industry and so on with CRUK. And now I'm actually taking this further with Cancer Research UK to actually, you know, develop this further. So we can save time.
Very nice. Okay, let's explore that a little bit more. So Bart and Chris, you're both leading a number of researchers, and presumably there's many different ways you can take your work, your research. You know, you can ask your students to investigate this or investigate that. Inevitably, some of these things have to be done on a bit of a hunch. That was more of a question than a statement, guys. You know, how do you really decide what you're going to work on? Do you get a good feeling about something, or do you, you know, have a good chat down the pub with your colleagues? Give us a bit more about the thought process.
Chris?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, where do ideas come from? I don't know. That's a different podcast, I think. That's more in philosophy. But yeah, I mean, you obviously you read papers, you go to conferences, you talk to people, and eventually, you know, I think you kind of get a sense for what, you know, what might be feasible. And obviously, you're always trying to do something new. I mean, it's a busy podcast. There's six of us. There's, you know, there's that, you know, tens of thousands of people working on cancer research all around the world in pharma companies, and you know, there's a lot of people out there with a lot of ideas. So coming up with something novel and creative is often the challenging bit. There's always somebody else doing. If it's a good idea, there's probably other people working on it. So what we try to do in my lab is come up with new technology. So we do half, so maybe 50% technology development, and that what that allows us to do is to then answer new questions that other people can't do. Because if we've got a platform where we can do something that, you know, the pharma companies can't do it, they have to come to us to collaborate. You know, we're a tiny little lab of 10 people, but the big, you know, AstraZeneca will be knocking on our door asking for us to help them, you know. So by developing new technologies, we can answer new questions. And that's what Callum's really been doing, is using the new technologies we've been developing to study how these cells communicate and interact. And that, to me, really is the value of academic science as well. We have that flexibility and creativity to sort of really try new things. But obviously, you know, if it continues to not work, then, you know, you try something else, as long as your funding permits. But yeah, I mean, at the moment I'm relatively junior in this, so yeah, I haven't had time to fail properly yet, but we're trying our best.
Let me bring in Bart. When we were talking yesterday, Bart, in preparation for this, you were talking about exploding tumors. You know, is that just one of these kind of crazy ideas you had in the shower one day, or, you know, how's that work?
Well, you know, I think Chris mentioned failures often when things are not working. You know, you think, why is that? So, you know, this was an idea born out of a failure. We have been trying for probably 20 plus years to take cells and to put one of these cancer-causing genes in them, and they don't like it. And I said, look, you know what? This is actually, rather than blocking this gene, why not try to activate it and make a molecule that activates this protein rather than blocking it? And so, you know, that's the idea I put to pharma, and they said, you know, you're gone crazy. And
I said, sounds like a dangerous game.
A dangerous game. But, you know, if a cancer cell is a balloon full of air, you know, you have two options to kill this balloon. You know, what we have been trying to do so far is to squeeze the air out of the balloon. It goes a bit floppy, but, you know, when the time is right, the air comes back and the balloon is back. And that's what's happening in cancer. So you tell me, if I now put 10% more air in this balloon, what's going to happen? It pops.
Bang.
And it's not going to come back. You will not blow up your balloon anymore. So that's what we have now made. Molecules that activate the cancer. Supercharge it, if you want to use this word. It's too much of a good thing. So, Mike, do you like a pint of beer?
I do, actually.
Okay. If you drink your first, it's not a problem. Okay. One pint is not a problem. But if you have drunken already five, the sixth one might kill you, might make you very drunk. A cancer cell is always on five pints. And I just give it an extra one and it just gets drunk.
Fantastic. So is this an idea that you have pursued? You know, have you got other PhD students working on this, or is perhaps Sarah is working on this? Let's bring in Sarah. What are you doing? So your boss has this crazy idea.
Yes.
And then it's down to you to try and make sense of this crazy idea.
Yeah.
What do you do next?
It's down to me not to make the idea. In my case, I'm making what I'm going to test the idea on. So basically, Bart is doing his crazy idea of developing something that might make the tumor burst. And my role is to find something to test it on, a model to have to test it on, because it's actually not easy at all to know how to test if the thing we think, the thing we've created is doing the thing we created it for, right?
Sure.
So it might do something. And actually, sometimes that's the case in a lot in drug development in general. Some drugs do the job that we expect, so cure this headache that we're having or this other symptom that we're suffering from. But sometimes we don't even know how it's doing so. So actually, sometimes studying the path or the way the drug is working is a bit harder than maybe doing the drug itself. So yeah. So my role is more on the understanding how Bart's ideas would work.
Okay. Sarah, this is going to be a horrible question, but can you explain to me, a layman, how on earth you do that?
So for instance, we have like the normal cells, and we more or less understand how these normal cells are working. So if you want to target one crucial point or one point that we think is crucial for the cells, and so, for example, Bart chooses this point that the cell depends on and develops a drug that should target this point. So my role is to create cells that lack, for example, this gene. Let's say it's a gene that we're talking about. So if normally the cell needs this gene to function properly, and if just we notice that this gene is mutated or different, works in like aberrant in cancer cells, so we try to artificially make cells that lack this gene or have more of this gene, or so we play a little bit with these conditions to try to create cell models that would help us test our hypothesis on. Hopefully I put it in simpler words.
No, I think so. I think you said that very nicely. Thank you. So I mean the picture I'm getting is that, you know, this is not straightforward. This is complicated stuff. It takes teams of people years to do. And, you know, you have to be dedicated. And maybe you need a bit of luck along the way.
I think a lot of observation skill as well, because it's more about noticing the tiny little differences between how this cell is functioning versus how this other cell is functioning and what effects we can notice from adding this or removing this from an environment, for example.
Good. Yeah. All right. At this point, Bart, go ahead. You got something to say?
Yeah. You know, Chris mentioned grant. So, you know, I think sometimes when you have a wacky idea or a crazy idea, you know, you need money to research that. And I think that has been my greatest frustration, that some of the more, let's say, non-traditional ideas often find it difficult to get to grant committees. And, you know, people are a bit conservative. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, I don't want to promote certain organizations more than others. But in my case, Cancer Research UK has been very supportive of, you know, keeping an open mind. And so the challenge is, Mike, even if you have ideas or things aren't working, you know, to find monies to pursue that idea. And that is often a bit the key challenge, I find.
Yeah, that's probably a whole another talk, a whole another podcast. Now, I've been talking to the scientists. I want to bring in the patients. I've got some specific questions for the patients, but I can see Jackie has got something to say.
Yes, I have something to say to Bart about these novel ideas, new ways of working. Do you use PPI to help push your ideas and ask for these ideas to be and research to be funded.
You know, this is an interesting. I'm being asked to join a workshop for cancer grant challenges, and you know, one of the ideas I would like to involve patients to get this through. I think if patients are on board, then I think that makes a big difference. But I have not so far.
Okay. I have to maybe you can have a chat afterwards. What I'd like to ask the patients really is that having more knowledge about cancer and kind of, you know, the disease that you suffered from, do you feel that helps you? Does it make your life easier or harder? Tell me, Dave.
It helps to understand what we've been through and how it happened. And it helps me when I'm supporting other patients in my support groups by helping them understand what's going on, how it's working. But there's still so many unanswered questions in research, especially as Bart mentioned earlier, long-term effects. That's a point for another discussion at some time. So many people are surviving cancer now. We just don't know what the long-term effects are. What's it going to do on the National Health Service? How we're going to cope with it? That is another question. That's another podcast at some stage. But it's understanding why can't, if we're using immunotherapy as a treatment, making it more active to fight that cancer, why can't we make it more active right at the start so we don't get cancer?
Oh, good idea. Yes.
It's one of those things, you know, everybody's looking at the treatment of cancer. We're not looking at how to prevent it. We can't prevent it at the moment. So it's another question. It is.
How can we boost those T delta gamma cells, is it, that was mentioned in one of these websites, before anything goes awry?
Yeah.
All right, well, cancer prevention, a whole nother podcast. We're getting towards the end now. So if people are listening to this, maybe, you know, they have cancer or they have a loved one that has cancer and they want to know more about it. Now, I've occasionally tried to read some scientific papers. Now, I'm not a scientist. I find them very hard going. Right. Is there any advice? General advice, if people want to learn a bit more about cancer, either the cancer they've got or, you know, someone in their family has, and that they're not a scientist, but they want to find out more, how can they sensibly do that? Any good sources?
Well, to be honest, I took part in an American study which demanded PPI and ICPV, Independent Cancer Patient Voice, provided it. And I was somewhat apprehensive because it was bench science. But it was explained to me in terms of that I could understand by breaking down a complex topic into simple steps and the use of diagrams and a short training session on how they achieved the cell manipulation they wanted. And it is a fascinating science. It's possibly not for everybody, but these things can be explained quite easily, I think.
That thing you just mentioned, is there a resource available on the internet? You know, where can people go?
That's a big problem with the internet. What we do need is the hospitals, the consultants, the GPs to refer people to the recommended websites and areas. Right. There's so many. If you look up esophageal cancer, you're looking at 70% people dying of this cancer. But a lot of people, 70% go into palliative care. It doesn't mean they're going to die straight away. It's making sure we look and we point the people in the right direction to the right websites. And we get those websites out there. Cancer research is good. There's a couple of charities in the UK which is good for this kind of cancer or any. But we need to make sure we got the right information out there. We don't scare people too much.
Right, I can imagine there's an awful lot of misinformation out there. It's the sort of thing that would get a lot of misinformation. Okay, well, that's another area we could pursue more in the future. It's like there have been certainly lots of questions asked or areas that we can chat about in the future. But for now, we're going to have to pull it to a finish. So, ladies and gentlemen, look, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat for the last 40 minutes or so. It's much appreciated. And I think this will make for interesting listening and potentially help a lot of people. So many thanks.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Very many thanks to all six guests on the show this week talking about cancer research. A big thank you to you for listening, and a special thanks to the show's sponsor, Alka-Seltzer, who bring regenerative orthopaedic medicine to the UK. See their website, alkaseltzer.com. If you or a loved one are in pain, do have a look.
Me, Mike Dill. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next time.